Welcome to the Radio Times Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Coming up this hour, Pennsylvania Auditor General Eugene DePasquale will tell us about progress being made in getting a backlog of rape kits tested and what this means for victims. We'll also hear from State Senator Andy Dinneman about a bill called Victoria's Law, which aims to put puppy mills out of business. But to start today's roundup, we're going to talk about so-called phantom candidates and how they might impact this year's freeholder election in Camden County, New Jersey. Incumbent Democratic freeholders Edward McDonald and Carmen Rodriguez are campaigning for re-election. And instead of facing just a handful of Democratic challengers, there are at least eight, six of whom seem to have tenuous ties to politics at best. The six might be what are called phantom candidates. And here to explain is Matt Friedman, reporter for Politico and author of the New Jersey Playbook. Hi, Matt.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Sure. So what exactly is a phantom candidate?
So there have been a lot of people that are allegedly, in fact, I think, you know, the evidence points to more than allegedly at this point, recruited to run for office by the power, you know, the Camden County Democratic machine. Their purpose isn't really to run, but just to crowd the ballot to make it harder to find, put candidates for local office, put other candidates for county office in a more obscure place in the ballot. They have no intention of actually running. And I think the fact that none of these people, you know, I only managed to get one of them on the phone, and he sure didn't sound like a guy who really knew what he was doing. So to really understand this is to understand how New Jersey has a pretty unique way of structuring its ballots that inherently gives the party in control a huge advantage, which is that candidates who file slates to bracket together. So you have, you know, this year the assembly is on the top of the ticket. It could be governor, it could be U.S. Senate, mm-hmm. but you have the Camden County Democratic Committee candidates all bracketing together from mayor, assembly, whatever at the top, on down, all the way down to the local candidates and even more granular offices. Mm-hmm. This way, they get a preferential spot on the ballot. This year, the sort of candidates that tie the columns together, if you will, are the freeholder candidates. So you have those two Camden County freeholder candidates running together, the ones who are already freeholders. And you had some, you know, some people, some anti-machine Democrats who decided they were going to field their own freeholder candidates to challenge them. And also in order to establish a line so they could actually get a column together with some candidates in local towns that could join with them and avoid getting put into what they call ballot Siberia, which is way over to the right side of the ballot. But what happened is all of a sudden, six other pairs of freeholder candidates, so 12 people, three other pairs, six uh-huh. people altogether, run, and they have slogans like Progressive Democrats for Change. But these people have no intention of actually running and are really just there to crowd the ballot so that these, you know, anti-machine candidates are all the way over to the right. Now since I've written this story,
let me just jump in for 1 second, Matt, because I want to get into the candidates in specific in just a moment. But if I'm walking into the ballot, if I'm walking into the booth and I'm taking a look at the screen, and where does the confusion lie? Where do people end up to the right on the screen in Ballot Siberia? And where does a voter's eye normally land? Where is the prime
right,
spot?
Well, you have each office is a row, and each slate of candidates is a column. So if you have a full column of candidates, you'll have a row, a whole column assigned to you. If you are running independently without bracketing with people, you don't have a column assigned to you, and you won't get precedence on the ballot, and so you'll be shunted over into a column far to the right.
So
to give you an example, there was a candidate running in this tiny town, Merchantville, last year, named Nina Scarpa, and she was not part of the machine, and she did not have a team to bracket with. So if you look at where she was on the ballot, she was in the ninth column. So basically all the way over to the right, you had to look at all these names to get over there.
Got it.
A lot of the names in between the machine candidates and her were what would probably be considered phantom candidates.
So could we draw a direct line from the machine then to these phantom candidates?
Well, in many cases, we can. I can tell you that in one, you know, in some cases, you look at the petition signatures of these phantom candidates and you see people who are low level you know, municipal officials, school board members in Camden County who are often Camden County Democratic Committee members. Sometimes these people are encouraging people to run. One of the candidates, the one of the quote unquote phantom candidates I managed to get on the phone said, yeah, this guy, Bill Murray, he's a school board member in Belmar. He encouraged me to run. And this guy, Kevin, is helping me out. And then I see this guy, Kevin Buccheroni, who's a Camden County Democratic Committee member, signing these other petitions for phantom candidates. And it doesn't really make sense that people who depend on the Camden County Democratic machine, who not only have these public offices, but also jobs, are signing petitions for people who are purporting to run against the machine. In one case, a guy who signed a petition for one of the supposed anti-machine phantom candidates won the George E. Norcross Humanitarian of the Year Award a couple years ago. Of course, George Norcross is, you know, the pinnacle of the Camden County Democratic machine. Mm-hmm. The award is named after his father. The idea that someone with that close connections would sign a petition of someone running against the machine, it doesn't really hold water.
What motivation is there for these so-called phantom candidates to run? Is there money someplace, or what have you been able to determine?
I have not been able to determine how they could potentially benefit, if at all. There's a million possibilities. These things are not public record. If they did exist, so I can't even begin to speculate. If I can't get these people on the phone to tell me why they're running, they're not telling me. They're not telling me how they're running, and they're not telling me in most cases who's getting them to run and why. I mean, I can tell you in this one case, this gentleman I talked to seemed
Jason
like a nice
Witt.
Guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, Jason Witt seemed like a nice guy. You know, his quote when I asked him to run was just like parks and stuff like that, how kids don't really have anywhere to go or anything like that. It's mostly like, I don't know. I didn't really think it was going to be taken as seriously as it's being taken. And when I continued to prod him and question him, I said, you know, there's a lot of people suspicious that you're just kind of a plant to take space on the ballot. And he basically said, you know what, I hadn't thought about that, but that kind of makes sense to me, and now I'm going to consider withdrawing. Hmm. Well, he didn't withdraw, but even he seemed to see where this was going.
So in order to help folks who might be voting, who live in Camden County, might be voting the Democratic ticket in the primary for Freeholder, you mentioned earlier that some of these candidates, whether they are legitimate or so-called phantom candidates, their slogans are similar, which is also confusing. You've got Democrats of Camden County. You've got Progressive Democrats for Change. You've got Change Today for a Better Tomorrow. You've got the mm-hmm. buzzword, change. What is a voter to do in order to discern who would be the candidate of their choice?
Well, that's part of the problem. I think the only way you could really do is go do research, see who has the policies you like. These candidates, you know, the phantom candidates, they don't have websites. They don't even have Facebook pages for their candidacies, let alone try to get them on the phone to discuss it. So you can probably dismiss candidates who seem to have no platform to run on or no reason to be in the race because they don't have anything to go on. In this case, you know, the actual candidates who are running against the machine and who I could get on the phone and who would talk, their ballots were actually tossed out because their petition signatures were tossed out by the Camden County clerk because they there were some forged signatures on one of their petitions, allegedly. But again, I don't really see this from my perspective as writing about the how good at certain specific aspects of the candidacies themselves is so much as political machine preservation tactics and how they're manipulating the ballot to ensure that anyone who really seeks to put a challenge to the machine is way out in ballot Siberia.
All right. Matt Friedman, is the existence of phantom candidates widespread or primarily limited to places where there is an entrenched party machine?
I think this is the type of operation that requires a party machine because it takes 100 petition signatures to get on the ballot. So that takes some amount of effort. Someone has to go collect those. And you need machinery in place to be able to do that. Whether this is limited to Camden County or it exists in other places with strong Democratic machines, I haven't really determined yet. I haven't been able to do that amount of research yet, but it's very much a thing where one party has a very firm grip on power and has the kind of political machinery necessary, the soldiers on the ground, per se, to get this done.
And I'm guessing phantom candidacies are not just products of Democratic politics.
You know, while I don't have any specific examples at this point of Republican ones, I can tell you that in 2010, this very same, you know, political organization, the Camden County Democrats, pretty much it's been established that they ran for the general election a fake Tea Party candidate in 2010 when a freshman Democrat, John Adler, Democratic congressman, was up for reelection. All of a sudden, this guy, Peter DeStefano, pops out of nowhere and doesn't have much of a campaign except the picture of him holding the Gadsden flag that the Tea Party used quite a bit. And he didn't really have any interest in talking to most reporters, didn't really have a candidacy per se, but he was on the ballot as a Tea Party candidate. Ultimately, that one didn't work. John Adler was defeated that year. But there is a history of this. And once again, in Camden County, in that case, it was on the general election ballot.
And again, there isn't anything about phantom candidacy that is illegal?
Well, I'm not ready to say exhaustively that it is or that it is not. Certainly, if you were paying someone to run a candidacy that they had no intention of doing, I'm not saying anyone here was paid, just to be clear, but I think in that kind of scenario, I could see that potentially being a crime. There's also wording on the petition signatures that say, you know, when you're signing a petition signature someone, that you're doing it because you genuinely want this person to run for office. There is a disclaimer there. So I'm not ready to say that there's absolutely nothing illegal about it, but I certainly wouldn't myself claim that what's going on here is illegal.
Are there efforts that you know of to investigate so-called phantom candidacies?
Not that I've been able to source to the point where I'm ready to report it. No. Well, let me put it that way.
Oh, well, we'll watch for that. Is this a recent phenomenon, Matt?
Well, it appears that in Camden County, this has been going on for most of the last decade. I haven't had a chance to really research into this, but you'll see the ballots are quite crowded quite often with a lot of candidates who seem to come out of obscurity. And then there's that one I mentioned in 2010. I've heard some rumblings and haven't had a chance to look into it that this has happened in other counties in New Jersey. I don't know if it's to the same extent, but no, this is not new. I just found that this year I had an opportunity to look into it and decided to dig into it a little bit.
All right, Matt Friedman, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Matt is a reporter for Politico and author of The New Jersey Playbook. Stay with us here on the Radio Times Regional Roundup. We've got Pennsylvania Auditor General Eugene DePasquale coming up next. He'll talk about a backlog of rape kits, that backlog going back years, and the process and progress in getting them tested. That's Auditor General Eugene DePasquale, and he will join us in just a few moments here on Radio Times. Stay around. You're listening to the Radio Times Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. A rape kit is a collection of evidence taken from a victim of sexual assault, which can then be used to help identify the victim's attacker. Several years ago, we learned that over 1,800 rape kits collected in Pennsylvania had been gathering dust, untested for at least a year. There were a total of 3,200 untested rape kits in storage. On Thursday, Auditor General Eugene DePasquale offered a promising update. He says the state has made significant progress in making sure most of these kits have been tested. Why did the backlog develop in the first place, and how does the picture look for sexual assault victims moving forward? Auditor General DePasquale joins us now on Radio Times. Welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me. Good morning, everybody.
So after news broke about the backlog, you looked into the matter yourself. Remind us why rape kits were being shelved.
So when we first started to look into this, from my team's perspective, it was late 2015. And there was a story that broke out of Detroit, Michigan, of thousands of these untested rape kits. And we were at an auditor's conference, and a lot of us were, and not trying to be flip about it, and we were, you know, at this conference, and a lot of us read what was happening in Detroit, and we didn't see a lot of action in our respective states. So we said, you know, we just didn't know what the situation was. So we just, you know, we came up with a strategy how we would go about this. So when my team, when we did our research and our investigation across the state, we found that there was a law that was in place requiring police departments to submit this data to the Pennsylvania Department of Health. And only 40% of the police departments were complying with that law. And from the ones that were complying, we saw that there were close to 3,300 untested kits, which meant the number was actually probably significantly higher because it's 60% of the departments not even complying with the law. So that's what that our original investigation uncovered, the roughly 3,300, a little under that, and only 40% police department compliance. That obviously put a lot of attention on this issue. So there's really, I would say, two main reasons why the backlog got to be that way.
So,
one was
– Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, so one was at the respective labs in Philadelphia, Allegheny County, which is where Pittsburgh is, and the state police lab, they had not added new staff or space for their crime labs in literally over a decade. So they were just short-staffed. Two was, and this is where it just wasn't a priority. Why it wasn't, you know, look, I wish I had the answer for that, but it wasn't. So
well, the fact is, Auditor General DePasquale, rape kits need to be processed quickly, correct?
Absolutely. Yeah, well, you do have some of them that anytime you process it, no matter how old it is, although the sooner the better, it still can provide useful information because you can get it into the FBI database. So one of the things that one of the older kits that had now been cleared in the backlog in Philadelphia helped just arrest somebody, and they're now being prosecuted in Philadelphia County from something that happened over a decade ago. So, again, the sooner the better. Obviously, you want to get these bad people off the street. But it is important to get this backlog cleared, and we are making tremendous progress on that now.
Is it correct that some of these kits had been sitting untested since the 1990s in Pennsylvania?
There was one kit in Philadelphia County. When I say Philadelphia County, that doesn't mean the crime was committed in Philadelphia, but it was in the Philadelphia crime lab, so it was in the Philadelphia region since 1992.
So what has changed to speed the process? There is a law that was enacted in 2015, correct?
That's right. So there's two main things. Number one is I think my original investigation shone a light on this. So more police. So now we're just shy of 100% police department compliance. So I think that's number one. Number two, legislative funding started to go into these crime labs, and particularly the state police crime lab. And three was there was a federal grant that works through the Manhattan DA's office that is going to states to clear the backlog as well. So those three things together has now made dramatic improvements so that, you know, where we were at least, you know, 3,300 in 2015, we're now at about 300 in Philadelphia County, and the state police crime lab have completely cleared their backlog.
Eugene DePasquale, what does the timeline look like? How quickly do kits need to get to a lab after the evidence has been collected? Do you have that information?
From the scientific standpoint, as long as there is a proper chain of custody, it can last a pretty long time. Like I said, some of these kits were sitting from 1992 and are still able to be tested. The problem is that you have potentially very bad actors that are still out on the street somewhere because they're not getting tested. So if there is a scientific limit on that, I'm not aware of that, as long as it's properly maintained. The problem is, again, that if you don't test it, you're leaving the potential for bad people out there. And it's not just in Pennsylvania. If somebody commits a horrendous act in Pennsylvania and they're not prosecuted, they can go obviously anywhere in the country, even to be blunt, anywhere in the world, and still commit bad acts.
You tell the story of a person who was accused of attacking and raping a woman in 2011 and then moved to North Dakota.
That's correct. And then was convicted of a sexual assault in North Dakota of a teenage girl finding this young woman online and luring her in and committing a sexual assault in North Dakota. If that kit had been tested in 2011 and that person prosecuted, for at least the allegation in Pennsylvania, that person would not have been able to commit that crime in North Dakota, which they obviously were convicted of it in North Dakota, still awaiting trial in Philadelphia. But at least if that had been done in 2011, that offense in North Dakota would not have been possible.
So speaking of progress, as of the end of last year, the crime lab at the Philadelphia Police Department's, the crime lab at the Philadelphia Police Department reported having zero kits which needed testing. The number was about 600 in 2015. Eugene, it's important to note that some kits can't be tested because victims need to give permission. Yeah. Are these kits considered to be part of the backlog?
If that is an important point to raise, and it's obviously a very sensitive situation, but if the victim doesn't give consent, it is not considered part of the backlog. So that's something that's important to consider, and there's a host of reasons why that would be the case. So when you see the backlog is eliminated, that means that the victim has given consent in each of those instances. So that's number one. Number two, if there is a kit tested, say, last night, it's not considered backlog today. So it's usually about a period of 3 to 4 months before it's considered part of a backlog. So obviously, when you see the backlog is eliminated, there could have been something happened over the weekend that still hasn't been tested. That's not considered backlog. So just wanted to point that out for the listeners as well.
Okay. Earlier, you'd mentioned grant money from the Manhattan DA's office. I'd read that Philly received a $400,000 grant from the Manhattan DA's office to test kits in its backlog. I'm just curious, why would the Manhattan DA's office give Philly money for this?
Yeah, I asked that same question myself, and that is that basically it's a federal grant that, for whatever reason, has been awarded to the Manhattan DA's office for the Manhattan DA's office to then, award these grants across the country. I, for the life of me, don't know why it went to the Manhattan DA. Not condemning the Manhattan DA one way or the other, as opposed to just, having the federal grant flow across the country from the Justice Department. Why that happened, I don't know, but that's the process. So it's not as if the Manhattan DA had a boatload of extra money that they're then spreading out across the country. It came from a federal grant.
We are speaking with Auditor General Eugene DePasquale, and Governor Wolf is asking for approximately $1 million in the budget for rape kit testing. Eugene, is this sufficient, do you think?
Enough money to eliminate the backlog. So there's two parts of making sure we don't get the backlog going forward. One is that $1 million, I believe, minus some dramatic change, would be enough to clear the backlog. So that's certainly very helpful, and I think a sufficient funding level. Moving forward, and part of this has been the state police crime lab, was simply just too small. So they have also, over the last 2 to 3 years, been providing capital infrastructure to the state police so they can improve and increase the size of their crime lab and add staff, so that we don't get into this situation again. So that $1 million is about the backlog, and then the capital improvements is about moving forward.
You say Pennsylvania should consider implementing a rape kit tracking system. How would this work?
Yeah, right now the state of Idaho actually has already done that, and they're allowing other states to use their tracking system for free. So this would be, other than the staff person at the Department of Health who'd be uploading the information, this would be, no extra cost to the Commonwealth. And basically, it's a tracking system, like I said, through Idaho, where you would basically barcode information and put it into this tracking system in Idaho. And that would help the law enforcement and the victims see where their kit is in the process. So, at my announcement last week, we had a victim of rape who still does not know the situation regarding her rape kit. She does not know what happened to it, has not seen the chain of custody, has no idea where it is in the system. This type of program in Idaho, implemented in Pennsylvania, would eliminate that problem. The victim would know exactly where it is in the system.
Is it possible a rape kit can get lost?
I hate to say, I guess anything is possible, but the most likely situation is
that it is simply on the shelf somewhere and people aren't aware of it. That was one of the reasons why, and she had to obviously be willing to do it, Samantha Fulham, she had to be willing, and you know, we made sure that she was as comfortable as possible talking about this. But it is one of the reasons why we felt it was important to have her story shared, is that hopefully the people that were involved in her, the rape that happened to her, can go back and try to find what happened to her rape kit.
And the more quickly a kit like that is tested, then hopefully the person who perpetrated the attack is then arrested quickly as well. So
there's no question. When she recounted her story, there were four attackers on her. Now, you know, she said that she does not know how many of them were actually, you know, they were all part of the rape. Whether it was one or all four or a different number or anywhere in between two or three that actually committed, for lack of a better term, the penetration, we don't know. But we know that four were involved in the attack.
Is the state offering her any other services to help her get through this? Do you know? You might not have that information at your fingertips, but
I am not aware. We didn't, the only thing, you know, I stressed to her was if there was something else that, you know, myself or our department could do to be helpful, to please let us know. That may or may not be happening, and I just don't know.
All right. But if there's any positive news to come out of this, there are processes in place now to help speed the testing of these rape kits so that perpetrators are then hopefully apprehended.
That's right. And we believe, by the pace we're on and with the money that Governor Wolf has put into his budget and from the feedback we're getting across the state, particularly now in Allegheny County where there still is a backlog, although it's reduced from where it was several years ago, that we believe by this fall the backlog will be eliminated.
Okay. Auditor General Eugene DePasquale, we've got a few minutes to tackle some other news. New voting machines, which leave a paper record, must be in place by the end of the year in Pennsylvania. Philadelphia City Commissioners have chosen a system called the Express Vote XL. This machine is in compliance with state rules, but back in February, you expressed concerns about the process by which the Express Vote XL was chosen. What were your concerns, and have they been addressed?
You know, my concern, and still exists, is that it appears, and again, and I think the Philadelphia Comptroller is now, you know, taking an aggressive stance on this as well, is that it appears that the request for proposal was written to meet this one company's machine. So whether, you know, this machine certainly complies with state law, you know, I do not dispute that, but I don't believe it was a fair competitive process for this company to get the bid, because it looks like everything in the proposal was written to meet this company's machines.
Well, let's talk about the company. It's ES&S, and apparently in Luzerne County, the director of the Elections Bureau in Luzerne accepted trips from ES&S, which, you know, provided that county's electronic voting equipment. And Luzerne's director, you know, apparently isn't alone among officials in various parts of Pennsylvania who accept such perks. Is this illegal under state law?
It is tragically not illegal. We can certainly make the argument that it is unethical, and we are all, and certainly I have that point of view as well, but it is not illegal as long as it is reported. And so what happened in Luzerne led to me having an investigation across the state. This company and another named Dominion were paying for, you know, whether it be wine tours, amusement park trips to Vegas, all over Pennsylvania. And to me, that is highly unethical and certainly should be illegal. Look, I understand people should have open dialogue about items, but when somebody's trying to get county or municipality or even state business, and they're taking you on a trip to Vegas, it simply should be illegal.
Governor Wolf has imposed a ban on gifts for appointees in his administration. You'd like to see that extended?
Yeah, I think that if what the governor did for his own administration, if we had that as a state law, not only would this not have happened, but people would have a lot more confidence in not just election equipment procurement, but procurement across the state. When I say procurement, meaning obviously buying, you know, services. And the idea that any election equipment, considering the critical 2020 presidential election we're going to have, that there's, of all the concerns people have out there, how we're purchasing our equipment should not be up there.
We've got a minute or so left in this part of the show. Eugene DePasquale, your office recently took aim at the Pennsylvania Turnpike Commission, saying it's on a road to ruin if it continues to rely on toll increases you say are unsustainable to pay off billions in debt. Tell us more about that and what you think needs to change.
Well, they're sending about $450 million a year to PennDOT without a revenue source to pay for it other than increasing tolls. And the tolls are just simply too high now, and people are choosing other routes. And next year, the Pennsylvania Turnpike Commission will have more debt than the entire rest of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania combined. It's staggering. And it is not sustainable. That the legislature needs to take action. That $450 million that's going to PennDOT has to end, and a new funding source at the exact same time should be created for public transportation, because I do recognize that that is critical and important for Pennsylvania to help people get to work and to various activities. But that money from the Turnpike Commission is simply just not sustainable anymore.
Where do they even begin? It's a monstrous problem.
It has to begin by ending that $450 million and finding another source of revenue for public transportation.
Well, that's the question, the other source of revenue. Any thoughts?
I put on the table that, look, if you regulated and taxed marijuana, similar to what has happened in Colorado, that would provide more than enough money for to fill this gap and have additional money for public education in Pennsylvania.
All right. Eugene DePasquale, Auditor General of Pennsylvania, thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me. Have a great rest of the day.
All right, you too, and I'm sure we'll be in touch soon. Just ahead, we will talk to State Senator Andy Dinneman about something called Victoria's Law. He is a co-sponsor of legislation before lawmakers. It would curtail abusive breeding practices often employed by so-called puppy mills. That's coming right up on Radio Times and WHYY in Philadelphia. Stay tuned. This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, and we are about to discuss something called Victoria's Law. Victoria was a 10-year-old German Shepherd whose story is, frankly, heartbreaking. She was born in a puppy mill in Lancaster County and spent most of her life confined to a cage, breeding litter after litter of puppies. Unbeknownst to the people who bought her puppies, Victoria also carried a gene which eventually paralyzed her. After outliving her usefulness to the breeder, she was eventually relinquished, unable to walk, filthy apparently, and frightened, to a rescue group and ended her days experiencing kindness from her new caregivers. But Victoria's story is far from unique. Commercial breeding operations continue to operate in Pennsylvania, and pet stores in many areas continue to sell their products. And so State Senator Andrew Dinneman, who represents the 19th District, is reintroducing legislation which would strike a blow at so-called puppy mills across the state. And again, it's called Victoria's Law. Andrew Dinneman is on the line now to tell us more about the legislation and the need for humane breeding practices. Welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you. It's important to be here. As you know, we several years ago passed laws to try to end puppy mills. They didn't end. They're still here. And hopefully this law will succeed by cutting off the financial base of puppy mill operations.
Andrew, we talked a little bit about what this dog, Victoria, had experienced. Tell us more about what animals in her particular situation can endure at the hands of some commercial breeders.
Well, what happens is that these animals are put in cages, often filthy and dirty cages, and they're simply used as breeding machines. And often the animals do this for years, the dogs do this for years, and then become ill themselves. This is a very inhumane way to treat any animal. And by the way we treat dogs and cats and animals in general is a reflection of the way we treat each other sometimes. And when we try to attain a more humane approach, it is also part of a humane approach for the way we treat each of us in our interactions.
The breeder which owned Victoria was legal and licensed?
Oh, yes. And this is a problem in Pennsylvania. You can be legal and licensed. We rarely have enough animal inspectors to go and to check. So you can both be a licensed breeder and an unlicensed breeder in terms of the puppy mills themselves.
Do we need to distinguish between breeders who do treat their animals humanely?
Oh, absolutely. And this law does not impact in any negative way a good breeder. What it does, and it's modeled after Maryland and California. In fact, there are 290 municipalities in the U.S., including Philadelphia and Pittsburgh, which have actually passed ordinances very similar to the law. What it says is that no pet store can sell a dog, a cat, or a rabbit for sale. And indeed, what has to happen is if they wish to sell puppies or cats, they then would use animals that are from rescues. It also insists that since a lot of pets are sold via the internet, that you have to put your license number down, your name and address, and that's what good breeders do anyway. And you will be able to have a way to check out the breeder and before you purchase the pet.
So in Philly and in Pittsburgh, how have these local ordinances changed the way pet stores operate in these cities? Have the stores embraced?
Many stores do embrace this, actually. Many of the bigger chains embrace this. In the Pittsburgh ordinance, not only do we have the matter of not selling, puppy mill pets or selling puppies, but we also have the advertising language that's also in this bill that if you want to check on the breeder, that the name, the address, the license number is there for you to do the research. And if the person is not licensed, then buyer beware. And so together, we hope that these regulations, not selling pets in pet stores, having a good way for you to check out the internet with reputable breeders, we hope that this will make a significant difference by cutting off the economic funds that the puppy mills get. In the latest studies that have been done in Pennsylvania, for example, over 3,000 dogs were imported in here to be sold. Actually, the number is that over 3,500 puppies were imported into Pennsylvania over the last year from mills and brokers, puppy mills and those who were the brokers for them to be sold in pet stores.
Well, if they're imported, how do you handle that?
Well, you're handling it because, remember, you cannot sell a puppy in a pet store. You cannot sell a kitten. You cannot sell a baby rabbit because you know what happens at Easter time. These rabbits are sold and then they're let loose, or people try to return it, or they give it to the shelter. What happens is, if you can't sell the puppy, let's focus on dogs for a second, then there's no money in the pet store. Then there's no money. You cut off the financial basis of the puppy mill operation. The law itself has not succeeded. When we passed our puppy bill law 9 years ago, and now we're trying to cut off the financial base as the state of California and Maryland have done.
So, State Senator Gentleman, if with unscrupulous breeders that are still in operation in Pennsylvania, does the Federal Animal Welfare Act offer any oversight, any relief?
Not much.
Any...
This is the problem. It doesn't offer much oversight. And what we really have to do is simply say that in Pennsylvania, we are a humane people. we are not going to allow puppy mills or the money from puppy mills to be generated. We're going to follow the lead of California and Maryland. We're going to follow the lead of our major cities and do this statewide, Philadelphia and Pittsburgh, and stop the sale of puppies, kittens, and rabbits in pet stores. They can still sell rescue animals.
Which is a win-win.
Which is a win-win, absolutely.
So,
and hopefully this will be one more way to stop the puppy mills and stop their sale in Pennsylvania, and an economic approach so it's no longer profitable. It seems to be a very smart alternative.
This is the second time, if I'm understanding this correctly,
that
Victoria's
last
law
time
has gone.
It
went before the legislature the first time around. It didn't get through. What happened there? And why do you think perhaps that the situation might have changed and that it might have more of a chance of passing this time around?
Well, last time that we put it through, it just didn't seem to get the go-ahead that we wanted. But this time, I think we're going to be successful. Over 27 senators have already signed on to the bill, which is over half of the Senate. We are working very closely with the Humane Society of Pennsylvania, which is pushing the bill with all of their resources and their contacts. And when the bill was reintroduced, I can tell you the response from the constituency here in Chester County was overwhelming in support of bill. We have to organize. We have to move this forward. I went through this 8 years ago when I put in legislation to end the gassing of dogs in Pennsylvania. At first, it was slow. At first, there was resistance. But once we got the citizens involved, the dog and the cat community are tremendously well organized on the internet. And once we get them into action, we succeeded on ending the gassing of dogs, and we'll succeed on this as well.
Okay. So, and I should mention it does, again, it has bipartisan support, and there is similar legislation before the State House. Do you have any sense of how many of these commercial breeders, is there a number of the unscrupulous breeders of the puppy mills that still remain in Pennsylvania?
No, because a lot of this is done underground. A lot of this is done through the internet. That's why we think it's so important to have this matter of advertisement, so you can check on the breeder, you can go to the internet, you can see who the reputable breeders are. You know, a good breeder wants you actually to come out and to see the puppy, to see they want to see you. They want to make sure that this puppy or kitten has a good home. So this will not only hurt the money for bad breeders, but it also will help good breeders because they're following good practices.
Andrew Dinneman, do you think there needs to be more money set aside in the budget for investigation and prosecution of bad mills? Of puppy mills?
Absolutely.
And do you see that happening? Do you see that money being allocated?
No, I do think what we see happening, though, is this. At long last in Harrisburg, people are seeing the relationship between pet abuse and human abuse. They're seeing that the same people who often abuse pets are the same people who abuse people. And I think that what you're seeing now is a realization, especially in this month of April, where we're focusing in on the problem of abuse, whether it be elder abuse, child abuse, sexual abuse, that we are seeing a recognition of the interrelationship of all this. And I think that's a good sign, and that we are understanding one of the aspects of violence in our society. The way we treat animals is often reflective of the violence and the improper way we treat each other.
I know you're working closely with the Humane Society on
Absolutely.
This. If you go to a pet store, which is offering animals from a shelter, what can you expect to find in terms of quality, for lack of a better word, as opposed to a puppy or a kitten that might come from a commercial breeder?
Excellent question. I think that the obligation, and we'll certainly work to make sure this happens, is that a full report of that puppy or kitten be there when you purchase it, the name of the rescue, your ability to contact and call the rescue, the history of whether it has had its shots, and the general health condition of that animal. I think one aspect of this, and in fact, it might be necessary for us to amend the bill as it goes through the process to make sure that when you go into a store and you get a rescue animal, you get a complete briefing on that animal, both any difficulties that animal, including any difficulty that animal has. Right now, when you buy a pet, you don't know if it has a genetic disease or other problems.
Even if that commercial breeder is USDA certified?
Often that, even if that is certified. I'll tell you my own situation. We rescued a poodle about 5 years ago. That poodle had AKA papers. That poodle had a genetic defect, and it was an AKA breeder that caused it to lose most of its hair. So here was an AKA breeder. Here was what one would think there would be no problems, and yet that breeder should never have done what he did, because it comes when you breed animals with two negative genes. So this occurs, and you know, it's like so many other things. Some people only want to make money, and unfortunately, we have to make sure that they're not making money off of animals and treating them inhumanely, and they're not making money off of consumers who want to have a dog or a cat to love, and then they find out that dog or cat, they still love them, but has a significant physical difficulties.
Is Governor Wolf on board?
We hope so. We're sure he will be. I have no question. Governor Wolf loves dogs, and I know that because I know his interaction with my own dog and the governor. And so I'm sure he's on board, and I don't think we'll have any problem getting him to sign this once it's passed.
Say, Senator Andrew Dinneman, we've done a number of shows on animals and pet care, and the one thing I think we've often taken away from the experts is if you're considering adopting or buying a pet, it's always a good idea to discuss the animal's needs and your lifestyle before giving into that cute face. And plus, it prevents a return a return to the shelter. I know we're getting off track here a little bit, but
no, you're absolutely right. You know, one of the incredible things that is happening now is we're only on the cusp of understanding of how important animals are to us as human beings. Just last week, Temple Grandin was here in Chester County talking about the impact that dogs can have on children with autism. We know that we've used dogs in terms of helping people with post-traumatic stress syndrome. So one of the amazing aspects now is our increasing understanding of the relationship of dogs and horses to helping people overcome their emotional needs, and this is good news because we see a change in terms of the perception. You know, in the Pennsylvania law, by the way, dogs and cats are considered agricultural commodities.
You know what? I'm going to have to jump in because we're almost at the end of the show here.
Just
a very quick question: when does this go before the legislature?
It's before him now, and so we will be fighting for it, and we'll be happy to report back to you as we go forward.
Okay. State Senator Andrew Dinneman, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Our engineer today was Diana Martinez. Our producers, Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thank you so much for joining us for Radio Times.